Mesopotamia and the Bible. What I'm going to present to you now is a variety of pieces of information, of discoveries from Assyria and Babylonia, which relate in different ways to our understanding of the Bible. We need to look first of all at the map and remind ourselves that we're dealing with one end of what is called the Fertile Crescent, this line of cultivatable country that runs from the Gulf right round to Egypt. People began to settle in Babylonia and build cities in the very fertile soil which they could irrigate easily before 5000 BC. A little before 3000 BC, a very advanced culture was appearing where writing was invented, the culture of the Sumerians. One of the important Sumerian cities was the city of Ur, down in the south, which at that time was closer to the Euphrates River than it is today. British archaeologist Sir Leonard Woolley excavated at Ur in the 1920s and uncovered a great deal of the ancient city. If you visit the site today, it's dominated by the ruins of the temple tower, the ziggurat. The ziggurat is a Babylonian word which means a mountain peak, and these towers were built 3, 4, possibly 8 stages, going in steps. There are 3 stages at Ur. I think it might sharpen just a little, Carsten. Thank you. Yes, thank you. And you see there are staircases going up so the priests could climb up to the top. There are some people standing here, giving you some idea of the scale. I took this picture on New Year's Day 1961. Since then, the Iraqis have covered the building in modern brickwork to preserve the ancient brick. And then during the Kuwait War, they had some sort of military installation on top, and it was bombed. But I understand that the only damage affected the modern brickwork. So the ancient brickwork should still be there. What it looked like in its heyday is shown by this model. It was built about 2100 BC by a great king of Ur, and so it was standing there almost certainly in the time of Abraham. So what I saw on New Year's Day 1961 was partly what Abraham saw when he was living there, I believe about 2000 BC or a little bit afterwards.
Is it made from stone?
It's made from brick. The most part of it is made from mud brick, simply dried in the sun, but the outside is covered with mud brick which has been baked in a kiln, just like the bricks of this building. And so they are very strong and durable, very hard. The bricks are about a bit thicker than these bricks. They're about so thick, and they're about 30 centimeters square. So they're much heavier than our European bricks. All made by hand, and some of them stamped with the name of the king. We'll see an example of that later. This was the temple of the god of the moon, who was the patron god of the city of Ur. It's interesting that Haran, the city to which Terah took his family, including Abraham, from Ur, was also a centre of the worship of the god of the moon. And the name Terah is related, apparently, to the word for the moon, Yareach, in Hebrew. And so is the name Laban, one of his descendants, a relative of Abraham, which means white. And it's possible that Terah's family was in some way associated with the worship of the moon god. We're told in the book of Joshua that your ancestors worshipped other gods on the other side of the river, that is, of the Euphrates. And it may well be that this family moved from Ur to Haran in connection with the worship of the moon, although the book of Genesis tells us that Terah originally intended to go to Canaan. So this building dominated the city in ancient times. In his excavations, Woolley uncovered 2 areas of domestic housing of the period 2000 to 1750 BC. You can see the streets and the buildings arranged around the streets. Some of them are houses, some of them are chapels or shrines, some of them were probably shops. The arrangement of the houses, very haphazard, is just like the houses in the old city of Jerusalem, Aleppo, Damascus of today. Here's a plan. Here's a view I took looking across the ruins of these houses in 1960, and you can see the lower parts of the walls were built of baked mud brick. The upper parts were simply mud brick dried in the sun, and they're disintegrating quite rapidly. Although there's very little rain, it does rain sometimes in this area, in the summer a very strong wind blows from the west, bringing a lot of sand from the desert, which has a scouring effect. It erodes the ruined buildings. And Willy only found two areas where the buildings of this period still existed. Over most of the rest of the city, they've been destroyed by erosion, because after about 1750, a large part of the city was abandoned, and so the ruins just lay there. In this area, later buildings had been built over the earlier buildings, and so helped to preserve them. In the ruins of these houses, Willy found all sorts of things. Let's just look at the house. We're coming through the front door, off the street, into an entrance hall, a vestibule, and then into the central courtyard, and the rooms open from the courtyard. At one side, there's a staircase. It may be that it led to an upper story. It may be that it only led to a flat roof. We're not sure. The walls are thick enough to support an upper story. The design is interesting. There are no windows in the outside wall, and that is because of that wind that I explained to you. They didn't have glass to put in windows, so if you had openings, the sand would blow in. Obviously the sand can blow in through the central hole, the central opening, but not to the same extent. Furthermore, by having the rooms arranged around a courtyard, even when the sun is at its highest and very hot, you can find shade at least on one side of the building. And when I lived in Baghdad in that year and the next year, I lived in an old Turkish house which had been built to exactly the same design. So over 4,000 years, the same design continued because it was the best suited for the region. The Baghdad municipality had built houses for people who couldn't afford their own houses. They made them of concrete blocks. They made them in a long line, all facing in one direction, with windows and doors, and nobody would live in them, because in the summer they got full of dust from the dust storms, and in the winter they were freezing cold, because they faced in the wrong direction. So the old ways can be the best. In the ruins of these houses, Willy found all sorts of things that had been left behind because the people ran away in a hurry when an enemy attacked the city. One of the most interesting types of object, very inexpensive and ordinary, are little clay plaques, little pieces of clay the size of my hand, which have been pressed into moulds. And each mould has a picture. What you see here is a picture of the goddess Ishtar, the equivalent of Astarte in the West, the goddess of love and of war, two things which can be closely related, standing on her animal, which is a lion. There are other gods and goddesses represented. What were such things for? Probably when you went to the temple or the shrine, you could buy one at the door and leave it inside to remind the god that you'd been there praying. And so the god would remember you. Because ancient gods were just like human beings, they could forget. Or you might buy it at the shrine and take it home with you and put it by your bed to say your prayers at night. And it would be a lucky charm to bring you good luck. As I say, we found a lot of them. They're obviously cheap, easy to make, not the sort of expensive decorated statues that wealthy people might have or leave in shrines. But not all of these clay plaques showed gods and goddesses. Some showed people of the time in their daily activities. And this is rather an interesting group of musicians. And you can imagine this fellow with his folding stool. You see, it's one of those stools that's hinged, so you can fold it up. It has a cloth seat. So he sits at the street corner playing his harp, and nobody throws any ore at him, so he folds up his stool and goes to another place and hopes that people will throw money into his lap. You see, he has a long skirt and his hair is done up with a band. Here's somebody else walking along with a lyre under his arm. You see, he has a short kilt, a different hairstyle and a beard. See the attention paid to the muscles in his legs? He's a very well modelled. We don't know what the purpose of such things was. If you were a harpist, did you buy one and leave it in the temple, saying to the goddess, please make me have a successful concert? Did you take it home as a good luck charm? Or were they, and I think this is most likely, were they toys? Your children, if you have children, may well play with plastic animals, dinosaurs, soldiers. It's the same sort of thing, I think, as we have today. And look at the third figure, alas, only half the figure. He has something like a guitar with ribbons hanging at one end, and his head is shaved except for two locks of hair. If he had a pin in his nose, he'd be a punk. And these are people from the time of Abraham. They show us what the people in there looked like at that time and the music they enjoyed. Alas, we can't reconstruct the sounds of ancient music. We do have a lot of information about the way they strung the instruments, the intervals between the strings. They had a 5-note scale and an 8-note scale. They knew about half tones and so on. But we don't know whether the strings were made of animal gut, of hair, of metal wire, or something else. So we can't, although we can recover some harps, we can't string them and produce what we know to be the ancient sound. People have tried and produced very strange sounds which don't convince me. Perhaps the most important type of object that is found in these ruins and in many other cities of Babylonia is the cuneiform tablet, the normal Babylonian writing material. Clay tablets, like about the size of a biscuit, you can easily hold them in your hand, the scribe would write on them. This is a legal deed about the purchase of property, a piece of land, let's say 10 acres in area. This is the size for 10. When you bought it, the document is sealed. You can see traces of the seal impression, and then the scribe writes the legal terms on the clay tablet. It's then put into a clay envelope. This clay is wrapped around the tablet, and the terms of the deed are repeated on the envelope. You can see the number 10 there, and the witnesses put their seals on the envelope. This was to prevent fraud. If you bought a piece of land, 10 acres, and you only had this tablet, you could spit on the tablet when it had got hard and put another sign there and say, oh, it was 20 acres I bought, give me the other 10. But if it were wrapped up in the envelope, you couldn't do that, because you couldn't gain access to the tablet without breaking the envelope. You wouldn't be able to put it together again, convincingly. It would be like cracking a nut, right? And if you tried to make a new envelope, you could reproduce the inscription, you'd have to bribe the witnesses to put the seals on, but even then it wouldn't work, because you'd be wrapping new damp clay round a hard clay tablet. And as the damp clay dries, it shrinks. And the tablet inside would not be shrinking at the same rate. It wouldn't be shrinking at all. So the envelope would crack and fall off. So it was a very simple means of preventing fraud. And this double document continued in use for a very long time. In the prophecy of Isaiah, of Jeremiah, you remember he bought a piece of land that belonged to his uncle. And you find he wrote a deed and sealed it up, and then he had another deed. And we know from examples from amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls and other documents of the first and second centuries, we have examples of this, where the papyrus document has the deed written on it, it's then rolled up, little holes made in the document, strings tied round and sealed, and then on the other half of the document you have the deed repeated. So you only open the sealed deed if the other document is damaged or smudged or there's some uncertainty about it. the sealed deed remains sealed unless there's an emergency that causes you to open it. These clay tablets don't only deal with legal deeds, they give all sorts of other information, marriages, wills, letters, business documents of all sorts, and as we shall see presently, works of literature. The legal information that we gain from these documents is best known from the laws of Hammurabi. Hammurabi was king of Babylon 1792 to 1750 BC on the preferred chronology, and here you see him standing in a gesture of reverence before the sun god. The sun god, the god of the sun, was the god of justice because he shines impartially on everybody. Whether you're good or bad, the sun still shines on you. So he was the god of equity, of justice. Hammurabi's laws are written in cuneiform on the stele here. If you come to study with me in Liverpool, I'll teach you how to read them. They deal with all sorts of aspects of society, and in some ways they're very modern. If a man has a wife who contracts an incurable illness, he can either divorce her with sufficient money to keep her alive for the rest of her life, or he can continue to keep her in the house. He may marry another wife, but he has to maintain the first wife as long as she lives. And in some ways that's better than the systems that prevail in our countries today. Provision was made for the care of people who would have no resources of their own. And Hammurabi was very keen on that. One of the interesting laws in his compilation can be related to the narratives about the patriarchs. Abraham and Sarah, you may recall, had no child. And this was rather a puzzle to them, since God had promised that their descendants would inherit the promised land. And they took steps to remedy the situation. Sarah said to Abraham, "Take my maid Hagar and have a child by her." And eventually Sarah would have adopted the child as her own. Hagar became pregnant, and she began to realize that she'd done something that her mistress couldn't do. And she began to give herself airs and say, "Well, really, I'm rather better than Sarah, aren't I?" And Sarah got rather cross and said to Abraham, "Get rid of her. Turn her out of the house." And God told Abraham not to. In Hammurabi's laws, we find a somewhat similar situation. Well, if a man is married to a certain type of priestess who wasn't allowed to bear children, the priestess could give her slave girl to the husband to bear children, which the priestess would then adopt. But if the slave girl becomes pregnant and gives herself heirs and tries to make herself equal with her mistress, she is not to be sold. She can't be turned out of the house. She's reduced to the lowest level of slavery. But she remains in the house because she's bearing the master's child. And so here we see a somewhat similar situation. We also have clay tablets which tell us of marriage contracts where if after 7 years the wife hasn't borne a child, then the husband may marry another wife or may take her maidservant and have a child by her who would then be adopted as the couple's own child. And there are other examples of contacts, of similar social customs that we can see between the patriarchal narratives and the attitudes of people in the early part of the second millennium BC. Now, a lot of these customs continued over the next 1,000 years or more, so they don't prove that the patriarchal narratives belong to this period, but they certainly show that they could. Other tablets are often just lists of names. You see this sign here, this means one individual, and it's followed by a name, another individual, and then three people doing something else. Lists of names. They can appear to be very dull. It wouldn't mean much to me if I had a list of all your names, except I would know who was listening or sitting in my lecture. But these names can also be revealing. I don't know about Danish names, but in England, if we find a piece of paper that has on it John, George, David, Michael, Sydney, we will see that they are all male names. Now, it may be somebody was just making up names and writing them down, but it could be a list of people, and for whatever reason, they're all men. If we find it says John, Paul, Mary, Jane, Sheila, David, Sydney, then it's a mixed group. But if the list says Jean, Marie, Claire, Ferdinand. You see, they're French names, they're not English names. If the list says David and Levi and so on, then they're Jewish names. We can learn a lot from lists of names. And some of these clay tablets, especially from the city of Mari on the Middle Euphrates, but also from many places in Babylonia, list names of a type which we call Amorite. And sometimes in the Babylonian text, the names are actually followed by the word which we translate Amorite. These were people who came from the west into Babylonia. And these names include names like Ishmael, Jacob, Isaac, Abram. And those show us that the names of the patriarchs and their families belong to this Amorite, this West Semitic group. West Semitic as opposed to East Semitic Babylonian. These were people who'd been infiltrating into Mesopotamia from the middle of the 3rd millennium BC onwards. Eventually they came in larger numbers and overran the area at the beginning of the 2nd millennium BC. Hammurabi, his name is a West Semitic Amorite name. And we can see that these names were popular, were current in the first half of the 2nd millennium BC, and they gradually fell out of use after that period. So when we see that the names of the patriarchs and their families belong to this type of name, we see an indication that they belong in the first half of the 2nd millennium BC rather than later. That doesn't mean that the stories necessarily come from the 2nd millennium, early 2nd millennium BC. People may have remembered the names and nothing about the people and invented the stories later. But the names seem to belong to that time. I mentioned that these scribes wrote all sorts of things on clay tablets, including works of literature. Long ago, when I was young, I was working at the British Museum, and I opened a drawer and found this tablet and another one, quite damaged, as you see, but very long. They have four columns of writing on each face, about 400 lines of writing on each tablet, and this is a Babylonian story, which we call the Epic of Atrahasis. The story that I indicated to you yesterday tells of the creation of mankind and the great flood. These were copies made as school exercises about 1635 BC. Here's the back of that tablet, and at the end is the title page telling us that it's tablet 1 of the story of Atrahasis, telling us the name of the scribe and the date when it was written. There were three tablets making up the story, 1,200 odd lines in all. As you see, it's badly damaged. Happily, we have other tablets which fill in, which duplicate and complete some of the missing parts, not yet the whole of it. And this story went on being copied for over 1,000 years in the scribal schools of Babylonia. We can trace the textual history of it. We can do the same with the famous Epic of Gilgamesh. I talked about Gilgamesh last night, the quest for immortality. We have tablets that tell us about the Epic of Gilgamesh, that relate the Epic of Gilgamesh, again from about 1600 BC. There's one in Yale, again partly damaged and incomplete, but certainly the poem of Gilgamesh. About 1600 BC, 1650 BC. We have other copies, the better known copies, from about 650 BC, 1,000 years apart. The text is not the same, the story is the same, but the wording is often quite different. Over that 1,000 years, the text has gone through what we might call editions or recensions. There may be different traditions, some oral traditions, eventually put in writing, different written traditions. And people have studied this, and one scholar in particular, has argued that by comparing the earlier and the later forms, we can see the same sort of changes that literary critics believe happened in the transmission of biblical texts. Source criticism, linguistic, lexical criticism. But we can only do that for the Epic of Gilgamesh because we have both the text from the 7th century BC and the text from the 17th century BC. If we only had the early text, we would not be able to predict how it would change to produce the later text. If we only had the later text, we would not be able to predict how it would change, how it would have changed from the earlier text. It's only because we have both that we can see the differences. There is no consistency in the way the changes have happened. And in many cases, we cannot explain why the changes have taken place. Why, in this text, one word is used for incense, whereas in the earlier text, a different word is used. Both words were current all the time. And it may just have been scribal whim. And this, to my mind, doesn't disprove the possibility of textual changes. We know textual changes occur. But what it shows is that we can't set up a scheme and say this is how the changes would have happened. And the text we have received will have changed in certain ways from an earlier form. It just doesn't work. And you can try it with other Babylonian and with Egyptian texts that have been handed down over long periods. In some cases, they've been handed down with hardly any change at all. The laws of Hammurabi, we have from Hammurabi's own time, we have copies made over the next 1,200 years. And there's hardly any change at all, except in some cases modernization of the language. The text remains the same. So we cannot say that when we have a traditional text, as the biblical text is, that it must have gone through certain stages of recension and editorial alteration. We cannot prove that unless we have the earlier manuscripts, and we don't have. Another aspect of Babylonian life and culture is the attempt to tell the future. Well, I don't know what the future will be for you. You won't enjoy the smell it. The Babylonians were very eager to know what would happen in future. What will my life be like? And as I told you yesterday, they tried to find out by looking at the entrails of animals they had sacrificed, especially the liver. And here is a very famous Babylonian model of a sheep's liver covered with information about what it means if there's a hole in this place or this place or this place. This is from about 1700 BC. Such models were used for training the priests who undertook divination. This was one aspect of Babylonian culture that spread very widely. They didn't only examine the livers. Here's a lung, a model of a sheep's lung, which has been annotated in the same way. And this idea spread far and wide. Here's one, I'm sorry the young lady's not here, who's excavated at Chatzor. This one was found at Chatzor some years ago. A model of a sheep's liver with different omens written on it. If there's a lump in this place, it's an unlucky sign for the following reason. If there's a crack in this place, it's a lucky sign. There was a crack in this place 50 years ago and the king conquered all his enemies. Something like that. That doesn't mean the king will conquer all his enemies again, but it means that it's a lucky period and you can get married or whatever it is you want to do. This Babylonian science, as I say, spread all over the Near East and it spawned a lot of descendants. It's likely that Hindu omen-taking divination that's still practiced today has parts of its origins at least in Babylonian omen-taking. And certainly it spread to Greece and Rome, and the famous message to Julius Caesar, "Beware the Ides of March," was uttered by a specialist in this sort of omen-taking. The fact that it spread to Canaan, as we see at Hatzor, reminds us that the Babylonian cuneiform writing system spread. And we've seen that in the Elamana letters. Here's another of them. This one actually sent from the ruler of Chatzor to the pharaoh. The scribes in Palestine and Canaan were not only writing letters, they had to learn cuneiform. and they often learnt from works of literature. Here's a fragment of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was found at Megiddo, copied out probably in the 14th century BC. It wasn't found in the archaeological excavations. It was found on the rubbish heap from the Chicago excavations by a shepherd who was wandering across the mound many years after the excavations finished. And that's often the way. The best discoveries are not made by the archaeologists. So we know the Epic of Gilgamesh was current in Canaan in the Canaanite times before the Israelite conquest. This map shows us all the places which sent letters to the pharaoh, marked in red, which sent what we call the Amarna letters. And the blue ones are places that are mentioned in those Amarna letters. But from the red spots on this map, you see how many places there were where there were scribed writing cuneiform in the late Bronze Age, just before the Israelite conquest, in Canaan and in Syria. The king of Sidon, I think it was particularly active. There were 80 letters from him to the pharaoh. The king of Byblos, was particularly active in writing to the pharaoh. But in all those places, there were people who could write cuneiform. And it's important to remember, as I said already, that the Bible, the biblical books, came into existence in a world where writing was well known, long established, and widely practiced. We shouldn't assume the Israelites were unaware of writing at any time in their history. Another aspect of Babylonian science, trying to tell the future, was looking at the stars, astronomy and astrology. I expect you have, as we have in Britain, in your magazines and newspapers, columns, What the Stars Foretell. Tomorrow's your lucky day if you were born under this sign of the zodiac. Well, that all goes back to the Babylonians. Here's a letter from a Babylonian expert to an Assyrian king, telling him about the observations of these stars that he'd been making, and that various stars were moving in a certain way that would bring good luck to the king. The astronomical observations are very valuable for astronomers today, because sometimes the Babylonians record the appearance of a heavenly body that only appears very rarely. And so they can work out this has appeared in, say, 700 BC, and then in 300 AD, so 1,000 years later it's likely to come again. That sort of information. They're valuable for other reasons as well. But from this developed, as I say, these signs of the zodiac, and we find on some tablets little diagrams about the stars with annotations telling us what this star formation means and which god is appearing, and tables telling you when certain stars are likely to appear based on observations made in the past, again with little drawings. They were very scientific, very careful in their observations, but although they were careful in their observations, they were not good at drawing theoretical deductions from what they observed. Their mathematicians were clever. 1,000 years before Pythagoras, they knew the theorem of Pythagoras. You know the theorem of Pythagoras? Yes. Well, 1,000 years before he was born, the Babylonians not only worked it out practically with a triangle with 3, 4, 5 sides, unit sides, they also understood the theory. And we know that because we have lists of Pythagorean numbers that the mathematicians had produced and did all sorts of things with them. Already in the time of Abraham, they had an approximation for pi, so they could find the areas of circular structures and holes. They could work out the amounts of soil to be removed to make a canal, that sort of thing. And they did a certain amount of theoretical work in mathematics, but they weren't very good at analyzing and deducing in the way the Greeks were. However, they were quite good at observation, as I say, and they observed the movements of heavenly bodies. And I believe that the wise men who appeared at the Nativity at Bethlehem, who'd been following the star, were descendants of these Babylonian astronomers and astrologers who had been watching the stars. And we know that in Babylonia, as late as the 1st century AD, there were still Babylonian scholars who kept alive this ancient information and applied it. So the three Magi, if there were three, may well have been Babylonian astronomers. Let's move to Babylon itself. Here's a plan of the city in its heyday under Nebuchadnezzar. This is the main city of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar dug a great moat and built a double wall around the city. According to the Greek historian Herodotus, I think three chariots could drive side by side in the space between these two walls. There are various gates through the walls. The most famous one is the Ishtar Gate here, which we shall look at in a moment. One of the great palaces of the kings was here, another one here, and here was the enclosure where the great ziggurat of Babylon stood, which was probably the basis for the story of the Tower of Babel, though that's a mysterious matter. And the temple of Marduk, the patron god of Babylon, who was worshipped on the ziggurat, stood just here. Nebuchadnezzar built a bridge across the river, quite a remarkable feat, and developed a suburb on the western side. We know very little about that. Excavations were made in Babylon by a German team before the First World War, and a certain amount has been done since by Iraqi antiquities officials. But there's a great deal more to be found out, I'm sure. The Babylon that we know is the work of Nebuchadnezzar. The Ishtar Gate was excavated by the Germans. They found there were two or three gates, one behind another, and they were decorated with these figures of strange animals in the brickwork, in relief work, in brick, glazed in different colours. They took a lot of it away and reconstructed it in the Staatliche Museum in Berlin, where you can see it today. This is a photograph from the museum. The animals are quite interesting. Some of them are natural creatures, like this bull. And you see how it's been modelled in the bricks, and then the brickwork glazed to produce the colours. The lion also is quite a natural creature. I don't think I've put in the other one. No, I'm sorry, we'll go back. On this gateway you can see some other creatures. Here's a bull, but these are dragons. Creatures with serpents' heads and tails, and lions' feet, eagles' claws. These are mixed figures. And it's quite likely that these figures are the sort of things that lay behind some of Ezekiel's visions. Remember, Ezekiel was a prophet in Babylonia. It could well be that he saw these figures, and they helped to inspire the strange creatures that are impossible to draw that come in some of his visions. Anyway, Nebuchadnezzar built this city, and he was immensely proud of it. The bricks that were baked in the kilns, before they were baked, were stamped with a stamp, like a rubber stamp in a post office or somewhere, with his name and titles. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the preserver or restorer of the temples of Esangila, that's the temple of Marduk, Ezida, the temple of Nabu, Marduk's son, the son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon. And this is reminiscent of the words of Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel. Is not this great Babylon which I have built for the praise of my glory? And you remember what happened to Nebuchadnezzar after he spoke those words. Well, it's curious that the last half of Nebuchadnezzar's reign is virtually undocumented. We don't have any Babylonian chronicle for that part of his reign. We don't have any inscriptions we can date to that part of his reign. I'm not saying that means we can believe what the book of Daniel says is historically true. I think it was, but there's no evidence. But it's curious that we have a blank at that point in history. Nebuchadnezzar was followed by two or three other kings, and eventually by one of his court officials called Nabonidus. Nabonidus. He was the last king of Babylon. We don't have any sculptures representing Nebuchadnezzar. We do have several that represent Nabonidus. He was a religious bigot who believed that the moon god was the only god worth worshipping. So he restored the temple at Ur that I showed you, and also the one at Haran where the stone was found. And then he went off into Arabia for 10 years. probably because the moon god was the principal god worshipped in Arabia. He set up his capital city at Taima in northern Arabia, and has left us inscriptions which show that his people went as far as Medina, which was then called Yathrib, one of the two holy cities of Islam, which didn't exist at that time, of course. While he was away from the country, the Babylonian Chronicle tells us that he entrusted the kingship to his son Belshazzar. Belshazzar was king de facto, if not de jure. He acted as king. So the presentation of Belshazzar as king in the Book of Daniel is not unhistorical. Here's one of the famous little cylinders, they're only so long, that were found in the ruins of Ur in the 1850s, just after a German commentator had produced a commentary on the Book of Daniel, stating that Belshazzar was a figment of the author's imagination. The author of the Book of Daniel had invented Belshazzar. He had no historical reality, because he wasn't known from any ancient record outside the Book of Daniel. 3 years after the commentary was published, this was found, which is a prayer by Nabonidus for himself and his son, the crown prince, whose name is Belshazzar. You must not doubt the Bible or any other ancient text unless you have very strong evidence indeed. What happened to Belshazzar? Well, here's the Rembrandt painting of Belshazzar's feast, which is in the National Gallery in London, with the words written on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsin, or Perez. The kingdom has been weighed in the balance and found wanting. What was the problem with these words? Aramaic was the common language of the time. Why couldn't Belshazzar's wise men make any sense of them? Well, it would be just as if someone wrote on the wall here, is that right? Those words. And what would it mean? It's meaningless, unless you're in a shop and you have prices. It was Daniel who saw that these weights, a mina, a shekel, and a paris, which is a fraction of a shekel, could be interpreted, as he did, to spell out the doom of Belshazzar. But to the ordinary wise men, it was just as strange as having those two words written on the blackboard and nothing else. So the Persians took Babylon, Cyrus of Persia became the king of Babylon, and Babylon lost its status as the centre of its own empire. It remained a very important city, but it was only part of the Persian realm. This is the famous Cyrus cylinder, which is often quoted as evidence for the return of the exiles from Babylon to Jerusalem. The end of Chronicles and the beginning of Ezra tell us how Cyrus issued his decree that the exiles could return and rebuild the temple. In fact, this inscription tells us nothing about the Jews. It simply tells us that Cyrus restored some of the gods that had been carried away from various shrines in Babylonia. But it indicates a similar policy to what we read about in the books of Chronicles and Ezra. The Persian rule was generally a beneficial rule. The Persian kings were not eager to subjugate the peoples in their empire. They tried to let them live their lives much as they wanted, so long as they were loyal to the Persian emperor, and the Jewish people were allowed to return to their city, to Jerusalem, and set up their own little state there called Judah or Yehud under Persian rule, so long as they were loyal to the Persian king. And you remember, in the Book of Ezra, their enemies were constantly trying to make out to the Persian kings that the Jews in Jerusalem were plotting to set up an independent rebel state. That wasn't the case, and the Persian rule was quite happy to accept them as a religious group in their own city, Jerusalem. Well, there's much more that we can learn from ancient Mesopotamia with regard to the Bible, but I think that's sufficient for this morning.
thank you very much. I think we should have the time for discussion, questions, maybe some other topics which we have been wondering upon in the Bible's description of Babel and Babylon and so on, which Professor Miller has not touched upon. So, please open your mouth and ask questions.
Just for clarification, you mentioned that the Code of Hammurabi was copied for 1200 years, right?
Yes.
I wasn't aware of that. So you have sort of, you can then in Babylon, you have, oh yes. So they just took out laws, specific laws?
Oh no, no, they copied the whole thing and it covered several tablets. Just as we have... Just as we have several volumes making up a book.
So as your Banipal, for instance...
Yes, in his library there are copies of Hammurabi's laws.
Several?
Yes, yes, more than one copy. And we have fragments from probably Nebuchadnezzar's time in Babylon and from a little bit later in another city. It seems to have been not that they were copied because they were laws that still had force, but they may have been copied... because the language was considered the best sort of Babylonian. I don't know what the golden age of Danish is, but it might be like Shakespeare's English, I don't know. It may be that there was some feeling that they were a model and that later lawgivers should look at them as they made laws. It seems to have been the rule that a Babylonian king, in Hammurabi's time, a Babylonian king would revise the laws and issue new laws at the beginning of his reign. And Hammurabi's laws are a compilation made at the end of Hammurabi's reign, I believe on the basis of cases that were brought to the king during his reign. We have quite a lot of letters to and from Hammurabi between him and various officials. In other cities outside Babylon. And quite a lot of them are asking for the king's advice in legal situations, or saying, here's a case I'm sending to you for a decision. And the king was rather like the Arab sheikhs in the Gulf states today, who sit in their big tents, and anybody can come with a petition, and the sheikh will decide, or ask one of his assistants to decide the way the petition should be handled. But certainly the laws were copied for well over 1,000 years, almost verbatim. It's possible that people thought because they were the king's edict, they shouldn't be changed. I don't know. But certainly they were copied with great accuracy.
The story of the Tower of Babylon.
Yes.
Does it have any context or text?
Well, the biblical text says it was in Babylonia.
Yeah.
Babel is the name of Babylon. Babel, Babylani means the gateway of the gods, which fits the story well. The city of Babylon goes back to at least 2300 BC, possibly earlier. It wasn't important until about 1800 BC. The Tower of Babel, I think, quite clearly relates to one of those ziggurats that I've shown you. But it has no time, no date in the story. It implies a situation where a great many people were speaking the same language. And what that refers to, we don't know. From time to time, people have claimed that a certain Sumerian text refers to a period when everybody spoke the same language. It does, but not in the same sort of context. It's not an appropriate parallel. Whether this is referring to a time when only Sumerian was spoken in Babylonia, before the Semitic people had invaded the country, what period it's referring to, I really don't know. At the moment, I think I find the Tower of Babel story a puzzle in terms of what we know of the ancient Near East. I'm sure it reflects a ziggurat. We don't know what the purpose of the ziggurat was, whether it was meant to be a staircase up to heaven, whether it was meant simply to imitate a mountain, so that the god's temple was higher than all the houses in the town. And we know that in the early cities of Mesopotamia, the temple was just set up on a low platform. And it may be that it was a natural evolution, that the platform grew higher as you rebuilt the temple over the ruins of the earlier temple. You encased it in brickwork and built a higher platform. We're not quite sure. And without knowing the purpose of the ziggurat, it's difficult to relate it to the Tower of Babel story with its explanation that we want to get up to heaven.
But how old is the oldest ziggurat found?
Well, the oldest ziggurat is that one at Ur, but these from about 2100 BC. It's not clear whether that was the first ziggurat, or whether these earlier temples that were built on top of each other were also called ziggurats. We just don't have the written sources to tell us. So there are unanswered questions, and at the moment I'm not prepared to make any statement about the Tower of Babel, except to say, I don't know. It's an interesting idea that mankind at one time spoke one language, and of course modern anthropology suggests that there was originally one human pair, somewhere in Africa they say, who presumably did communicate with each other in a single language. What it sounded like, I have no idea. And presumably for some time they only spoke. That's a very unpleasant attitude, Nick. They only spoke in one language. But when you get large numbers of people living in different areas, then languages do begin to become distinct. An American is no longer the same as English. If I go to America and walk on the pavement, I'm likely to be run down by a car, because that's where the car goes. But in English, the pavement is where I walk, and the car goes in the road. So languages diverge, and diverge quite rapidly. As I said yesterday, I find it a paradox that God should mix up human language and then make his revelation in one and eventually two or three languages, and leave us to translate and present that revelation as best we can in all the other languages.
In Genesis chapter 11, we two times meet the phrase Ur Kashdim.
Yes.
Abraham came from Ur Kashdim. We meet another time in the book of Nehemiah.
Yes.
As far as I remember, only those three times.
Ur is not called that anywhere else, but it doesn't occur anywhere else, does it?
No.
But the Kasdim appear in the book of Daniel.
Yes,
of where they are the wise men.
But with the phrase Ur Kashdim,
yes.
It's only those three.
Well, this, I'm sure, is meant to distinguish that Ur from any other, because there were other Urs. There was another Ur, in English we call it Ur of the Chaldees. There was another Ur in Turkey. And one or two people have argued that actually Abraham came from that Ur. But it seems to me, for very, very many reasons, quite unlikely. I think that the explanation was put, perhaps by an editor of the book of Genesis, at a time when people weren't quite sure where Ur was. And the Chaldeans lived in southern Babylonia. They were a tribal group related to the Arameans who invaded Babylonia early in the first millennium BC and settled along the Euphrates. And so this belongs to a first millennium context. I don't think it belongs to the second millennium. It can be described best as a gloss, an explanatory gloss. You know, Genesis 14, the story of Abraham and the kings who captured Lot. There are several places mentioned, and in each case it says, which is so-and-so. And that is the same situation that we will meet quite often over the next few years when we read books about the Soviet Union before the collapse of communism, and people will have to say, Leningrad, which is St. Petersburg? Because children growing up from now onwards will not know that St. Petersburg used to be called Leningrad. And this is a perfectly normal process in compiling historical records. But what we mustn't do is to say every time we see an explanation like that, it is a later addition to the text. Because we have Assyrian inscriptions where a king says, I conquered such and such a city, which is also called something else. And then we have situations where the Assyrian king gave the city an Assyrian name, or perhaps his predecessor had captured it and renamed it. But the local people called it something different. And so both names are preserved in the text contemporaneously. It's not a later addition. But I think in the case of Kastim, or Kastim, it is a gloss that was added sometime later to make it quite clear where this place was. A long, long way away from you who are living in Jerusalem. Right over there on the Euphrates, a place you've never heard of.
But one should imagine, really, that you would have, if it was simply just glossing, it would be a lot easier to just to use something like Babylon or whatever.
Well, that would have not have been so precise, because the Chaldeans weren't living in Babylon until Nabopolassar's time, certainly. They weren't ruling Babylon. So this would indicate it's further south in Babylonia. So they're more precise. Sennacherib fought the Chaldeans, led by Merodach-Baladan, and he fought them mostly in the south. He actually had Phoenician craftsmen build ships so he could sail in the marshland in the Gulf to crush the Chaldeans.
He didn't succeed in doing that, did he?
Sorry, I'm getting old and I
still didn't. He didn't succeed in crushing them.
He did to some extent, but not totally, no. They were always troublesome to the Assyrians over the next half century. And there was one leader in particular, I think he was a descendant of Merodach-Baladan, who was a nuisance to the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal, Sennacherib's grandson. And Ashurbanipal kept trying to capture him, but he always ran away into Iran and escaped. And eventually, Ashurbanipal invaded Iran and captured Susa and destroyed the tombs of the ancient kings and destroyed much of Susa. And a local king of Elam had the rebel killed and sent him pickled in salt to Ashurbanipal. But Nabopolassar, the father of Nebuchadnezzar, was a Chaldean, and he ended the Assyrian Empire. So these things often come round. Yes.
How was the communication at this time between the Mesopotamia and Egypt, for example? Was that along that question?
Which time are you talking about?
About Abraham.
In Abraham's time, there was no direct contact between Mesopotamia and Egypt. It's a very strange thing. There's no mention of Egypt in any of the Babylonian texts. And I think what happened was that people traded from Babylonia up the Euphrates, across to the Mediterranean coast, but then other people took the material, took the trade goods to Egypt. The Babylonians didn't travel down the coast of Palestine by sea to Egypt. And the situation may have prevented them travelling over land. There seems to have been no contact until after 1500 BC.
So it is rarely unusual for a family to move from Earth?
Well, for a family to move, like Abraham, no, I don't think so. We have quite a lot of records of merchants who moved, and in some cases their families moved with them, trading from Babylonia and especially from Assyria into Turkey, where they were able to obtain silver. They took woolen cloth from Babylonia, which the people in Turkey liked very much, and also tin,
which they obtained from Persia somewhere. They were middlemen. They took the tin to Anatolia, where they could make it into bronze, alloying it with the copper that's found there. So I don't think there's any problem about Abraham moving with the family.
And the gods which Abraham and his family was worshipping, do we have any clue of what they could be, the moon god you mentioned?
No. All we have, of course, is the biblical text. The expression that occurs sometimes in the biblical text, the God of the fathers, is also an expression known in Babylonian texts. And there seem to have been family gods. From slightly later than the patriarchal times, we have texts which show that the eldest son was the guardian of the family gods. And it's suggested that when Rachel stole the teraphim from Laban, she was trying to ensure that Jacob was put in the position of the eldest son. Sorry?
Jerusalem.
Well, he met Melchizedek there, but did he offer a sacrifice there? Was it in a temple? It says Melchizedek came out to meet him. So I don't think you can press that. But if it was somebody else's temple. He never built one. A lot of biblical scholars will say that the places where Abraham had temple, had altars and planted trees became shrines. I'm not entirely convinced of that. But I think they were momentary. This was where he worshipped at that time, and he moved on, and that place was forgotten, so far as he was concerned. It wasn't a sacred place that he went back to. In the case of Jacob, you have a place which was important in his life history, Bethel. And he did go back. But that was to show that the promise that God had made was fulfilled. Jacob said, if you look after me, when I come back to this place. And so it was important that he did go back to Bethel. But I don't think that you find the sort of religious observation in the patriarchal stories which appears to have been what was usual in Canaan at that time, where you have shrines with priests and all sorts of ritual. So there's a distinction. But more than that, we can't say about the gods of God or gods that Abraham and his family worshipped, apart from what the Bible tells us. And I don't think that's inconsistent with what we know of the ancient world, but we can't produce evidence from antiquity, apart from the Bible, to show this sort of religion. Yes?
Do you think the worship of the moon god has anything to do with the apparent avoiding of the normal word for moon, in the creation story, in Genesis 1?
Oh, it could do, yes, it could be.
Yes,
it could be. It's quite possible that Genesis 1 has lying underneath it, a piece of propaganda against polytheism, Babylonian or other polytheism. This was argued by a Seventh-day Adventist scholar some years ago. Hassel, yes. Gerhard Hassel, yes. Mm-hmm.
I think it is interesting that this expression, your father's God.
God of your fathers.
Yes, God of your fathers. God of your fathers is applied to Isaac, Jacob, and not to Abraham.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, I think, as I said, it's quite possible that Abraham's family worshipped other gods.
Yeah.
The phrase in Joshua may refer to them, it may refer to Jacob's family, because remember Jacob says, get rid of your gods.
Yeah.
But it seems to be quite clear in Genesis that God calls Abraham, and that's a new beginning.
Yes.
There must have been some residual knowledge of God through Noah's family.
Mm.
But I think the call to Abraham was probably Abraham said, well, who are you?
Yeah.
But we're not told that.
Mm.
How can we know what went on in Abraham's mind? That's the sort of thing we can't find any archaeological evidence for. And of course it falls into this area that is outside scholarly study. You can't prove God spoke to Moses. And I might stand up and say the angel Gabriel appeared to me last night, but you can't prove that he did or he didn't. But it can have an impact. I wrote an essay some years ago in which I quoted the case of Joan of Arc. Do you know Jeanne d'Arc?
Yeah.
French girl who led the French against the British, against the English, and drove the English out of large parts of France, because she said God or angels spoke to her and told her to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody can prove or disprove that, but we can see the result of it. But so often people say, oh well, if you have that sort of element in the biblical narrative, the whole thing is unhistorical. And that's quite a wrong attitude.
A final question? Genesis 1 certainly has a Babylonian color, strong Babylonian color on it.
What makes you say that?
I think there's some parallel in structure.
Yes.
Between Genesis 1 and other, and some of the Babylonian creation.
There is a slight parallel with the so-called Babylonian Genesis.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's very strong.
Okay.
And I would say if there is a parallel, it's due to common tradition, common concept.
Yeah.
And also, if you think about it, a fairly straightforward understanding of how the world could come into existence.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have plants without water,
mm-hmm.
so water must exist before that, and certain things can't happen without light, and so you can work it backwards. The parallels used to be drawn between the Babylonian Genesis story, which we know as Enuma Elish,
mm-hmm.
and the first chapter of Genesis, but almost all of them have proved to be illusory.
Yes.
For example, the Babylonian poem was written on 7 tablets,
yeah.
and people said these were like the 7 days of creation. But it's entirely accidental that they're written on 7 tablets. It's nothing to do with the story at all. The story is not primarily about the creation of the world. The Babylonian poem is a hymn in honor of the god Marduk. And Marduk is praised as creator.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this was a role that he took over from another god. And the Babylonian creation story is in fact a pastiche of several different stories, bits taken from earlier stories, and then a very long hymn relating the great names of Marduk, the 50 names of Marduk, and explaining what each one means. The creation of mankind is a sort of incidental episode within the story, and that again is taken probably from the Epic of Atrahasis. So a lot of the parallels don't exist. When man was created, he was created from the blood of a god that had been killed. We now know from Atrahasis that the blood was mixed with clay. And this perhaps is like the creation of man in Genesis, where clay or mud is used, and the terminology is the terminology of a potter.
Mm-hmm.
But then God spits on the clay, or breathes into the clay the breath of life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the same concept, to make it malleable and suitable. But many other things are completely different, and of course the Babylonian story is thoroughly polytheistic.
Mm-hmm.
And you even have the gods fighting each other. And one god has to be killed to produce the blood which helps to make mankind. The idea that man has a sort of divine element is perhaps common. The mankind was made in the Babylonian story in order to look after the earth and to grow food. And this is perhaps like Adam being put in the garden. But the purpose of growing food was not so much to feed mankind as to feed the gods. And the Atrahasis poem shows us what had happened. There had been senior gods, the professors, and junior gods, the students. And the professors made all the students dig the garden and run the canals and grow all the food so the professors could sit and do their research and have their dinner brought to them. And the junior gods got fed up with this and went on strike. It's the first strike we know of. and they marched on the house of the god in charge of the earth, were going to set fire to it. But being a god, he flew up to heaven and escaped, and had a big council with the other senior gods, one of whom came up with a solution which I felt like recommending to Margaret Thatcher when she was Prime Minister of England, which was to execute the leader of the strike. So the gods duly did that, and from his blood, mixed with clay, they made mankind in order to look after the ground and grow the food to feed the gods, who could then sit back and enjoy themselves. And that's the Babylonian reason why we're here. So I think the Babylonian connections are much less than has been argued in the past. The Atrahasis poem offers some other interesting similarities in that it's a story of man, of creation of the world, very briefly, then of mankind, right through to the aftermath of the flood, which is rather like Genesis going through until the end of the flood story.
And we then think that the parallels, in quotation mark, between Genesis 1 to 11 and the Atrahasis, and the supposed parallels between Genesis 1 and the Gilgamesh, the Atrahasis epos gives us more parallels.
Gives us better parallels.
Better parallels.
And of course it's much earlier, it's from the 17th
that
century.
That was the interesting point.
No, I imagine that this is what I imagine, that Abraham, coming from Babylonia, knew some of these stories, possibly knew them in a, shall I say, monotheistic form, which has come down to us in the book of Genesis, from a much earlier time, whereas in Babylonia, as the Babylonians were polytheistic, the stories themselves had a polytheistic element, nature. But that's what we can only speculate about. And of course, the Babylonian manuscripts themselves exist in copies much older than the earliest copy of the Book of Genesis that's available to us. So the common idea is to argue the other way and say the Hebrew scribes have bowdlerized and depolytheized the Babylonian stories and fitted them to their monotheism.
Besides, we cannot exclude that
of course the
polytheistic versions of the creation and the flood really reflects something that happened.
Yes.
Old memories.
Oh yes, I'm not talking about the facticity of them, the factuality of them, but about the modes of transmission. The question of the historicity of the flood is another question.
Yes.
Nobody was there at creation.
No.
So we don't know how that story came into existence. So God may have revealed it. One theory was that God revealed it on each day of 7 days. I don't think that holds, but it's an interesting concept. To Adam or to Moses or someone in between.
And the fact that the Genesis version of both of the flood and the creation is much simpler in some aspects. Much more straightforward.
Yes.
Compared with the Babylonian versions, which have a lot of various elements together.
Yes.
Does that suggest anything?
To me, it suggests that they go back to an older source.
Yeah.
Other people say, well, they're simplifying what was complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't prove it one way or the other.